Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Just a quick announcement before today's podcast. This is actually part one of a four-part podcast series I'm dedicating to how to reverse aging. Yes, this is all about gerontology, which is, for a lot of us, a subject matter that hasn't really crossed the mainstream barrier. It's all about aging as a disease process and how to treat it. You're going to find the next four podcasts in this series absolutely fascinating, and Sue is a perfect guest to kick it off because she really lays out the history of this industry, this scientific field, and I know you're going to absolutely enjoy this podcast. So without further ado, here it is, and look out for the next three after this week's.
And one of the clearest messages that came from my book, which I found absolutely fantastic, was that the single biggest risk factor for that whole panoply of geriatric diseases is the aging process itself. So if we can come, you know, they're the branches of the tree, the roots of the tree are the aging process, your immune system that's getting old, your senescent cells that are accumulating, the inflammation in all sorts of things, all of these things. So if you can treat, if you can find a way of slowing that process or ameliorating that process, you can actually affect all kinds of things.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi, where we discuss the most important topics and concepts in the medicinal qualities of food and lifestyle. This is the podcast to learn about actionable changes to your diet and your lifestyle that can lead to health benefits. My guest today is Sue Armstrong, who is a writer and broadcaster specializing in science, health, and development. But as you will learn, her career has spanned so many different topics. It's incredible. She has written one of my favorite books from 2019. And in fact, it might be one of my all-time favorite books. It's an incredible story of aging and the area of gerontology that has garnered a lot of interest. It's essentially how we can treat and reverse aging. Yes, I know it sounds far-fetched, but trust me, at the end of this podcast, which is quite long, I definitely realize that it's one of my longest, but you will learn so much more about the science behind this fascinating industry and topic that spans a lot more than just lifespan. It's about quality of life. Her book, Borrowed Time, is a must for anyone's reading list who wants to dive into a topic that spans cancer, inflammation, and other diseases of aging that we can treat if we get to the root cause of what is going on. You can find all of this information and more on thedoctorskitchen.com, where you can also sign up for the newsletter and you'll get weekly recipes as well as lifestyle tips to help you improve your well-being and live the healthiest life possible. Please follow my guest as well on Twitter. It's at Armstrong_Sue, and check out the book. Again, all the links are going to be on the website, thedoctorskitchen.com. Give this a 5-star review if you enjoyed the podcast as well. It really does help spread the message. I'm not going to talk for much more. The only last thing I'm going to say is the recipe that you hear me cooking for Sue can be found on my YouTube channel as well. Again, thedoctorskitchen.com. You'll find all the information there. I'm going to stop talking now and get onto the podcast. Thank you so much for coming in, Sue. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. I was actually reflecting today that it's amazing. I'm in such a privileged position where I can read an incredible book and I can invite you, the author, to come down and share a meal with me and then chat about it.
Well, it's a great pleasure. I mean, this is a really unusual way of doing it. Usually you sat in some dusty little studio with somebody talking to you from miles away and it's awful. This is lovely. And I get to get a meal as well.
You get a meal. You get a free meal out of it. So we chatted on the phone. And I remember you saying that you like pomegranates. So I've basically made a meal around that. I'm going to roast some chickpeas in dakka. I don't know if you've had dakka before.
No.
It's kind of like za'atar. It's like an Egyptian spice blend with sesame seeds, coriander, fennel, some cumins in there, a little bit of chili. It's not too hot. I'm going to roast that with a little bit of oil, and then we're going to build a salad around it. So a bit of smoky hummus on the bottom, some fermented pickled onion that I've got here. Parsley, you okay with parsley?
Yes,
yeah.
Ooh,
okay,
yes,
good.
Yes,
yeah, because some people, it's a bit, you know.
Why don't people like parsley?
So genetically, there is a variant that makes people adverse to coriander. I know.
Yes, I know that one.
And I think there might be something similar with parsley because it can be quite off-putting, but more so with coriander. But anyway, you're not one of those,
no,
so
I'm
gonna
not.
Go with the parsley. And then I'm gonna put in some grilled artichoke as well.
Lovely.
Sound good?
Sounds wonderful.
Great. So tell me about how you got into broadcasting, because you have done a lot more than just the incredible book about aging and gerontology, which we'll get into in a little bit. But you've had some incredible experiences ranging from broadcasting about HIV to Nelson Mandela. Tell us about how you got started.
Well, I got started in journalism. I grew up in a medical family, completely medical family, and I was always interested in medicine, but I always wanted to be a writer. But nobody in my family knew how to become a writer, and they thought if you're a writer, you have to, you know, you're a novelist, and I didn't have novels in me. And so I did all sorts of bits and pieces, and I did a bit of traveling and so on. And then when I was a very, very young mum, I had this urge to do it, so I just started writing at my kitchen table and got lots and lots. Along the way, I kept finding people who believed in what I was doing and gave me an opportunity. And then I met somebody who said, well, you know, because I had got two small boys and I needed some more work. Mm-hmm. And somebody said to me, you know, the World Health Organization has all these articles which are sent in from the field by doctors that need sprucing up to put them in their journals and so on.
Right.
So why don't you write to WHO? So I wrote to WHO and had a great big lump in my throat thinking, this isn't going to work. No, you know, it'll go in the bin like most proposals do. And it just happened to land on the right desk.
Uh-huh.
And this guy got me to do some editing. Then he took me over to Geneva and he became my mentor. And he was wonderful. And I happened to be working at WHO when on a freelance writing assignment when the first mention of HIV appeared in that little crusty little journal, what was it called? Morbidities and Mortalities Weekly Report, which is a statistical thing from CDC in the States.
Okay, yeah.
And any really interesting statistics that come out, suddenly they find, you know, there's a blip in something. Mm. So they write a little note at the bottom and say, does anyone know what's happening here?
Wow.
And this was gay men in California with pneumocystis carinii pneumonia.
Mm-hmm. Which is an atypical pneumonia that it's one of the pathognomonic features, I think, of HIV.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so then they'd had this big meeting at CDC and they dumped all the papers on my desk and said, you know, we don't know what this is, but write us something about it. Mm. So I wrote something about it and, you know, it then grew and grew. And so I stuck with the story but I was always freelance. And then I got involved in lots and lots of things. And then I started working for New Scientist magazine, went out to South Africa working for New Scientist.
Wow.
Always as a freelancer and followed my nose wherever interesting stories came up, and that's it. Then I came back to Britain from South Africa and decided I wanted to do, again, I wanted to do long-form stuff rather than just everyday journalism. And And first one I did was on pathology and pathologists after the problem at the Alder Hey debacle, you know, when there was the pathologist who was collecting baby organs and so on, retaining them.
Oh, wow. I had no idea that you...
Well, I did, yes. I did some radio broadcasts on that.
Oh, my
because
goodness.
I suddenly, one of my pathology friends phoned me and said, Sue, look what they're calling us in the paper. They're calling us doctors of death. Mm. And in fact, the NHS, you know, most people wouldn't get the healthcare they get without pathologists.
Yeah.
So I suddenly thought, yeah, what do pathologists do and what sort of people go into it? So I did some radio programs, and then the Pathological Society came to me and said, your broadcasts were very useful. They really changed our image. They were important.
Brilliant.
What else can you do? And so I decided to do a book for them. So I did that first. So I've stuck with books since then.
Yeah. So when was your first book then?
My first one was I did one years and years and years ago on for kids on smoking and what's in it for you, a kids' self-help book.
Yeah, yeah.
That was years ago.
Uh-huh.
And then I did one on a Namibian freedom fighter in the 80s. And then I did the AIDS book and I did, and then these last two with the aging one and the P53
one. The P53 one, yeah, which we'll definitely come back to in terms of when we talk about reversing aging and the important genetic mechanisms that protect us. But that's fascinating. Your history and your career has just been spanned so many interesting topics.
Well, it has, but I mean, that's the massive privilege. I keep on thinking to myself, what a privilege. You know, you can be a extremely nosy person like I am, and you get a passport. It's your job to go and ferret out stuff. And this just, when I went out to South Africa, New Scientist had never had anybody out there during the apartheid years. And so I was going out to South Africa and I said, can I string for you there? So the sky was the limit. There was just any story I wanted to cover, basically. It was wonderful, really wonderful.
And you were privileged to be one of the few to witness Nelson Mandela coming out of imprisonment.
Wow. I mean, that, as I think I've said before, that just sometimes you look back on things in your career, like with the AIDS thing, and I realise, okay, I witnessed the birth of the history of AIDS,
yes.
And none of us knew that we were watching that arise, and gradually it did. But with Mandela, we all knew to be outside the prison, this was history being made there and then, and it was just wonderful. But there was a little bunch of us working with the main BBC correspondent. Mm. And so we were deployed around the place, and I was deployed to go and outside the prison.
Wow.
So I was waiting outside the prison when he came out, and it was an intoxicating moment, as you can imagine.
I can imagine, yeah. And that must have just been like, it's one of those things that you'll just never, ever forget, I'm guessing.
Never.
It's just one of those pivotal modes in history. I think it's everyone remembers where they are at certain parts of history. I remember where I was during the 9/11 incident. I remember actually even Kobe Bryant recently as well.
Yes.
I remember who told me, I was actually working in A&E at the weekend when it occurred, and somebody told me to check my phone. And I was like, oh God, it's terrible.
So
some of those incidents, isn't it?
Where were you when Mandela was released? Can you remember?
Oh, I don't know. I think I was too young.
Oh, yes, I know. Oh my God, that's the
young
thing.
Yeah, I think my parents told me about that, but yeah, I can't remember.
Because I was going to say when Kennedy was assassinated too. Kennedy will be a historic figure to you.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't there. So just to go back to the recipe very quickly.
That's wonderful.
Great already, yeah. I've just put some leaves around the outside, some of the smoky hummus with harissa. The onions, all I've done is I've sliced them in half moons, put them in a mixture of hot water, vinegar, salt, sugar, and some fennel seeds and coriander seeds, and just left them. You don't need to marinate it overnight. It's one of those quick pickles that you can actually leave for about half an hour, and it just turns these into like beautiful jewels of red onion, some of the grilled artichokes, the oil of which is really, really well marinated, so it's perfect for chickpeas.
And is that olive oil?
This is just olive oil. Yeah, and I put those chickpeas in there, and when they're ready, I want to pop them out. I think they might be ready in a second actually, because you don't need to do too much in terms of the chickpeas. Just pop them in. So tell me about how you actually went into gerontology itself. Like, what was the triggering interest for this amazing world of reversing aging I mean, I've got tons of questions I want to ask you, but I'll save that for the second part. But when did it actually come onto your radar?
Well, I did a series of radio programs for the BBC on the biology of some time back, and I did the biology of addiction, the biology of appetite, biology of all sorts of things, biology of stress, and one of them was the biology of aging. Okay. And I went over to the States, as you do, because there's all, you know, the national institutes of everything over there. Yeah. And I found it very interesting. And when I'd done my P53 book, Bloomsbury came to me and said, what would you like to do next? And my first choice was I wanted to write a book about vultures. Uh-huh. Because in South Africa, I became very fond of these birds, and they are wonderful, and they've had a very bad press.
Yeah,
and he said to me, well, you know, there's good news and bad news. I love your idea, but the bad news is I've just signed somebody else up to write about that.
Oh, really?
So go away and come back with another idea. So I suddenly thought, well, you know, every day one's hearing about aging.
Yeah.
And I had these lovely bits and pieces, and I thought, that'll be an easy one.
Yeah, yeah.
Woo!
No.
it was massive once you get into it. I mean, I realised that it's just a huge canvas. Mm. And at first I was very ambitious. I wanted to look at the philosophy of whether we want, you know, of longevity and whether we wanted to live longer and all sorts of things. So I wanted to look at that. And I wanted to look at the demographics and personal things and the psychology and so on. Then I realized that, in fact, there's quite a number of books on could we live to 150? Could we live to 500 years? Could we live to 1,000 years? And would we want to? And I thought, there's quite a lot already on that, but there's very little that's actually looking inside the body. Mm. And I'm always curious about what's going on inside. And getting older myself, you know, I began to get aches and pains and stupid little things. And I thought, what's actually happening?
Yeah.
So I took a leaf out of Gunther von Hagen's. You remember he did that wonderful exhibition, The Body Worlds. Have you seen
his Body
Worlds?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I went. This was when I think I was in medical school. Incredible exhibition. Actually, I do remember when I watched that for the first time, because he did the live autopsy on Channel 4.
Yes, he did.
I don't know if it'd be allowed anymore now. I mean, this is when Channel 4 was pretty edgy. He inspired, I think, a whole generation of people to go into medicine based on those exhibitions. I think it still goes on.
It does. Yeah. They're all around the place, and you know, they were very controversial, because people thought that it was ghoulish, because they were real people. Mm. You know, it wasn't just bits of anatomy. Mm. They were real people, and he'd got this special way of embalming them, plastination. Mm. And it was just so exciting, this exhibition. And it made me realise, you know, you've got a pain in your shoulder, you've got a pain in your hip or something, you've got a pain in your kidneys. You don't really know where they are if you haven't ever dissected a body. So I thought, well, I'll do the Gunther von Hagen's treatment. I'll peel back and have a look inside. And I found it just the most fascinating quest. I really did.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's where it all came from.
Fantastic. All right, I'm just going to grab these chickpeas out. I think they are just about ready. I don't want to get them too brown.
And how
brown.
Do you tell when they're ready? We're just a little bit brown.
Just by looking at them and the smell and just the fact they're a tiny bit brown. And that's all we're looking for with the salad, because I want it to be a warm salad. But they look like nice and golden. They've got a little
beautiful.
Bit of colour there. Yeah, yeah. If you put it in too long, they start popping around your oven, and then you've got an oven full of
a big cleaning job.
Chickpeas. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember the some of my fondest memories at medical school were during doing anatomy sessions, because we were really fortunate at Imperial. We actually had our own cadavers that we would share with essentially about 15 of us, and most medical schools have prosection, so everything's already pre-dissected, and then you just essentially get guided by one of the anatomy demonstrators. One of the things that we were taught right from day one is to be exceptionally respectful of the cadavers, that there's real people who'd given their bodies for science. And I guess the same thing could be said of Body Worlds as well, because, you know, people have had donated their bodies for science, and it does inspire the new generation, even though it does seem a bit ghoulish. It's, you know, the reality of life, really.
It is.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, when I did the pathology book, I actually went to Kentucky to the body farm.
Oh, wow.
That was set up by this guy, Bill Bass, and it was the first body farm where he was putting bodies around in sort of in nature, to see how a body does decompose when, you know, after a murder or something like that.
Yes, I remember, yes.
And I went along thinking, well, you know, he'd take me to his office and we could sit and chat. And he said, no, I'm going to take you to the facility.
Oh, wow.
And it was wonderful. Really, it was. Wow. It wasn't in the least bit ghoulish. It really wasn't. They, as you say, they showed such respect. Mm. And these people had contributed so much to our knowledge about important things.
Totally.
So, yeah, I think bodies are really very important things and very, very special things. And I have huge respect for the people who are prepared to, you know, aid our knowledge by passing
them. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and we will talk about it in a bit, but one of the bits where you talk about the Alzheimer's citizen community, essentially people who were responsible and willing to, you know, undergo research, chat to researchers, like the, I think it was the Jenkins family.
Yes, it was, yes.
And they've, you know, they've been pivotal in expanding our knowledge of this horrendous condition that afflicts, I mean, millions of people around the world. And that needs to be paid a lot of credit to, I think.
Yeah, it
it's not just about people in labs and doctors, it's actually us as a community.
Absolutely.
Together.
Well, I mean, look at AIDS as well. Just look at AIDS. Mm. I mean, it was so much the activists who pushed the science and helped the science and worked with the doctors and so on, the people who really were on the front line. Phenomenal.
Mm.
And so I think it's very important, actually, to get, to recognise the contribution that ordinary people have.
Definitely, yeah. Right. This is your salad.
So, wonderful.
just to recap, we've got the roasted chickpeas with the dakka. We've got tons of things there for your gut health, plenty of different phytochemicals in the greens. We've got some ferments in there as well, a little bit of grilled artichoke and some pomegranates, obviously.
And the phytochemicals do what? What's
So phytochemicals are like my favorite subject. There are literally like thousands of them. I think we've isolated over 5,000 now. And they are essentially micronutrients that we don't recognize as necessary or essential, like vitamins and minerals, but they are responsible for different processes, including cell signaling, mitochondrial function. They change the function of some of our longevity genes, like SIRT1s and
really?
Really? Yeah. There's some incredible stuff that we know about phytochemicals, and that's why it's all about nutrient density. It's about diversity and colors. To simplify it, you want to get as much complexity into your food as possible. So having two or three different portions of vegetables or fruits at every mealtime is one of the best ways you can improve your longevity and overall well-being.
So, and I mean, with the calorie restriction aspect of longevity, they call themselves cronies now because it's calorie restriction, optimum nutrition.
Yeah.
You have to make sure that you get all the nutrients.
Yes.
You know, you're not deficient in anything because that'll kill you. That'll cut off your longevity.
Absolutely, yeah. Because I remember, I think you talked about in the book where it's not just about calorie restriction. It's actually about the nutrient milieu. It's and I can't remember the researcher that you probably know, but when you optimize calorie content and the energy density of food with nutrient density, then you can have some potential further benefits, right?
Yes.
How was your lunch?
It was delicious. Really, really delicious. I love the smokiness. I love the mixture of things, the crunchiness and so on. And I absolutely love that. What is it called? The dakka. The dakka, yes.
Yeah. So
really, really good.
Packed some up for you so you can use that in some of your
Because there's lots of interesting little flavours. There was aniseed and there were lots of things you could identify separately. It was wonderful.
Yes.
Really perks it up.
Good, good. And I learnt about how to make pomegranate molasses for yourself as well. So I'm going to be using that in a video later. First of all, I want to talk about just how important I think it was that you injected a beautiful narrative into your writing behind the laboratory researchers, because for a deeply scientific book, it was absolutely gripping. You know, there were stories of lions, story of like Drosophila, the fruit flies with memories. I just thought it was fantastic. And for everyone who's listening and watching as well, it's definitely one of the books that I think was my favorite, one of my favorite reads of 2019.
That's wonderful to hear.
I'm glad.
We'll just say the thing about adding stories to it. I found this wonderful quote from an American astrophysicist called Jana Levine, and she said, and I saw it in New Scientist, and it sprung out at me. I thought, yes. She said, science without storytelling collapses to a set of statistics and a ledger full of data. And I thought, that's exactly it. It goes on the shelf and nobody knows about it. And science is so exciting. And the people, you know, they're seen as people just in their white coats, just poring over stuff. What goes on in their minds and their imagination and their ideas are fascinating. And the things that they do, you know, they blow up bits and pieces. And as you say, they tame lions. They do all sorts of stuff. So I get the backstories of these people because I like to see what brought them into the field they're in as well.
So. Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's just so important you do that, because behind every new character in the book, you do a little bit about, you know, how they look, or like, you know, what their colleagues think of them and what their upbringing was and how they went into the field as well. Because aging as a research area is kind of, well, it's definitely had a branding issue up until the last perhaps decade or so. Now it's like the new thing to do. But back in the days where people were looking through microscopes in the 1960s and 70s, it wasn't the most attractive. In fact, like you say in the book, a lot of people were discouraged to go into aging medicine.
Absolutely. Yeah. They didn't think there was a future in it, for one thing. But the other thing was, it was so stigmatized as being associated with snake oil salesmen and narcissism and, you know, people who just wanted to sort of the fountain of eternal youth. And it was pie in the sky. I mean, there were always people who were prepared to pay for that. But that wasn't science any longer. It was myths and dreams. Yeah. But so gerontology had a bit of an image problem. But it's so exciting. It's making such great advances and so on.
Yeah, there's two things I want to ask you, but I want you to answer them at the end, if that's all right.
Okay.
The two things are, do you think that gerontology and the notion that we can reverse and delay aging is a narcissistic endeavor that is, you know, that when people parallel it to climate change, whether that's a good or a bad thing? And do you think lifespan is plastic? I already have an idea as to how you're going to answer those, but we're going to come back to those at the end of this conversation. How do we differentiate real gerontology versus the immortalist sort of brand that it's had?
Well, I think when I started out, I thought that the immortalists and the transhumanists, I thought they were probably a little lunatic fringe, and I could have a few nice chapters on that. Then I realized that in fact there are a lot of seriously good scientists who are very keen on that sort of thing. But you can tell the difference because I mean, gerontology it's a very wide field, but most of the people, what they're selling is the idea of increasing the health span, not the lifespan necessarily. If you increase the health span, sure, you're going to live on to your sort of natural age, but that's not the thing. What they want to do is help people to live independent, healthy lives as far as they can into old age, because at the moment you may have two, even three decades of really ill health, which is miserable. So what they're wanting to do is shorten that period and keep people in their own homes so that they drop off the perch having had a good life.
Yeah, absolutely.
As somebody said, I want to die young. I want to die young at a very ripe old age. Yeah. And I think that's the message, really.
I definitely think that's like the overarching message I got from the book, is that's what we should be aiming for, considering, you know, the amount of morbidity that we have, the piling off of medical complications and diagnoses that we currently think aging is related to at the moment, certainly in the NHS healthcare system. One of the things that I noticed, and I don't know whether this was intentional or not, but you talk a bit about the hallmarks of aging, the telomerase issues, the protein misfolding, and then essentially the chapters are going into each of those hallmarks of aging individually and giving the backstory behind that. Was that something that you did intentionally or?
No.
Okay.
It wasn't. I mean, what I normally do is I set off with an idea and I do huge amounts of research. I get very excited by it. And then I start to write and it writes itself. You know, the story sort of evolves. Mm. I think the hallmarks of aging were very good because they were an organising principle. They were the things, because people say, what is aging? Yeah. You know, you look at a person, you don't know necessarily how old they are. And so it's a bit like time. It's one of the things we all know what aging is until you try and pin it down. Yeah. And so those hallmarks pin it down. Mm-hmm. And I think to that extent, they were obvious things to write chapters about, you know, like senescent cells and like telomeres and all of that sort of thing. They were obvious things to choose, but that wasn't the organising principle I used.
Okay.
Well, if there was one.
Yeah, I know. What it seemed like, you know, you took us all on a journey through all these different features of ageing, which, I mean, I feel like just having this conversation with you and reading the book, I've learned so much about a field that I never knew existed when I was at medical school. And just the thought that ageing could be seen as a disease that is treatable and have underlying root causes, if we can attach ourselves to trying to think about how we treat those mechanisms, then it reveals a lot of ways in which we can treat other conditions, conditions associated with inflammation, conditions associated like cancer, for example, and the uncontrolled cancerous growths. So that's what I find really interesting about it. So the hallmarks of aging, I've got them here because I can't remember them, but epigenetic changes, change in cell communication, inflammation, the buildup of senescent cells. Perhaps we should talk about senescent cells. What are senescent cells and why do they occur?
Senescent cells are actually very interesting. They're one of the hottest fields in gerontology and trying to do something about aging. What they are is, if you go back to the beginning, you know, how our bodies build themselves and develop and maintain themselves is through cell division. So the cells divide and they create a clone, they reproduce their DNA and they hive off a clone. Now, over the years, because it's happening the whole time, it's very easy for our DNA to make a mistake. And so we have a natural limit to the number of times our DNA can change. And when it comes to the end of that, which is measured by various things, which you can talk about, but when we come to the end of that, the cell senesces. It stops dividing any longer. Some of them, but most of them don't die. They stick around. And they gradually, they're there for a little while, and then they get cleared away by the immune system. So they're there the whole time. And the very word senescent cells sounds as though this is synonymous with aging. But in fact, we start creating senescent cells almost in the womb, in the development process, because it's part of, you know, you need senescent cells to, you need cells to die so that you can clear them away, so that you can mold the body and all of that sort of thing. So development is, senescent cells are part of development as well. But as I say, they get cleared away by the immune system. What happens is, as our immune system begins to get a bit ropey as we get older, it's not so efficient at clearing away the senescent cells, and the senescent cells stick around, and then they start to cause problems because they haven't died. They carry on metabolizing, which is burning sugar to create energy. So they go on creating free radicals and damaging things, but they also secrete things into their environment. And this is where the problem lies, because some of the secretions from the senescent cells are what they dissolve the collagen. And the collagen is what sticks our cells together and gives us nice springy skin when we're young. And it dissolves that, and that's when you get the wrinkles and the baggy bits. So in a way, I mean, they're an anti-cancer mechanism, because if while the DNA is being copied, you make mistakes, part of those mistakes is what evolution is all about. But you can also make mistakes that can be very dangerous and even lethal. And so you want to stop cells having the capacity to do that, start with new stuff. So that's the thing. So it's basically an anti-cancer mechanism. And the irony is that when these cells leach out, when they leak the stuff into the collagen and get rid of the collagen in places, they leave gaps in the tissue. And sometimes there's little bits of cancerous cells that are hanging around in the tissue, kept in check by firm young flesh and a strong immune system and so on. Your immune system begins to be a bit ropey, your collagen is beginning to leave spaces and so on, and some of those cells can grow, which is one reason why cancer tends to be something that spreads a little bit when you're older. So they're very, very interesting. But one of the things I always find fascinating about biology, it's never just a simple, this does this and this does that.
That's exactly the point I wanted to come onto, because we make it seem as if it's quite binary. Like, yeah. Oh, senescent cells, get rid of those are bad. But actually, like you just said, we need senescent cells.
We absolutely do. Yeah. Absolutely we do. What they found is that one of their jobs is when you get a wound or something like that, they congregate around the wound and they bring in the healing. They call in the other things to heal wounds and so on. If you don't have senescent cells around, the wound healing is very much slower. And one of the fascinating things is that you look at things like some of these amphibians, like the axolotl, you know, which is a little sort of newt thing, chop off its tail or chop off its arm, and it will regrow it again. What they've found is that, and the buds are where you get regeneration of these limbs and so on, you get an absolute cluster of senescent cells. So they have got things that are important. But the problem is, as we get older, that they stick around just too long and they accumulate. They should be recycled the whole time with, you know, with the immune system. And that's where the problem comes. So you don't want to get rid of them altogether. You want to... I mean, some people, I've seen them written about as zombie cells because they do damaging things. I keep thinking this is a terrible thing to call them because it makes them sound, as you say, just like a bad thing. Yeah. But we wouldn't get very far without them.
Yeah.
So, you know, so you need to find ways of making sure that they're cleared out fast enough and they're not hanging around too long. Yeah, that's the most important thing.
So this is really interesting because I think most people will think about, you know, senescent cells, zombie-like cells, because of the name that, you know, we should be just getting rid of them. But like you just said, with the amphibians who can actually regrow limbs and stuff like that, they cluster around the limbs and then you have these senescent cells and then they get recycled. So it might be an issue with the recycling of senescent cells. And that, again, I suppose, goes down to our immune system, the other factors that are responsible for
That's right. There's so many, nearly all of these systems, you know, so often science goes in, it homes in on a very small area, but you have to sort of stand back and see it. And the reason, you know, senescent cells are fine if they stay just as long as they should stay, when you've got a nice young immune system coming along and saying, hang on a minute, it's your time's up, and getting rid of them. But if it isn't, if your immune system is beginning to get a bit ropey, can't find its way to the senescent cells and so on. So it's all of these things working together. That's the thing.
I love the analogies in the book. Richard Farragher, who has lectured me on the Nutritional Masters course that I was on, talks about the immune system of old people like one of those hotlines that you ring up. I just thought that was fantastic.
He made me laugh so much. I so enjoyed interviewing Richard. I keep listening to my interview and there's loads of peals of laughter because he had these wonderful analogies.
Yeah, the analogy was your young immune system is there to ready and get rid of senescent cells and clear all the inflammation factors, whereas in the in older age, it's almost like you're getting through to the immune system hotline and you're told to wait. And you're like, the immune system will be with you. Just hold on. And you're waiting.
Your call is important to us.
Exactly.
Hang on. And then you get some green sleeves music or something. You listen to that for ages. And meanwhile, you've dropped dead.
Exactly. Yeah. So the slow mechanisms behind it, our immune system might be at the heart of why we see issues related to aging. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was your meeting with Judith Campisi, I think,
yes,
it was.
Yes.
And you've written a whole book on P53. Tell us about P53 and its importance to aging in general.
Well, Judith Campisi was fascinating because she was working in aging science and she was working on senescent cells, and at one point the people working in aging and the people working in cancer weren't really talking to each other. You know, they were each working in their own sort of silos and they'd have their conferences and so on. And I went to a P53 conference and Judith Campisi was there, and she's the senescent cell lady. Now, as I say, senescence is one of the mechanisms to help us prevent cancer. And P53 is one gene that we have in all the cells of our body, and it's a tumor suppressor gene. And it's one of its chief functions is to parole around and see that when our DNA is being copied to when our cells are dividing, that the DNA is copied faithfully. And if it spots that the DNA hasn't been copied faithfully and there's a danger there, it stops the cell and it either calls in the repair team, or and then it mends it and then it starts cycling again. Or it decides, well, you really are a danger, and so it can kill the cell, and it gets the cell to commit suicide, a process called apoptosis. So P53 is there doing this job the whole time, but senescence is the one where it stops the cell cycling. And so senescent cells and cells which have stopped cycling, and P53 is one of the mechanisms by which stops them cycling. And so these two things were very, very important. And the cancer people who were looking at P53 suddenly realized, yes, aging is just the other side of the coin. It's the price we pay to keep our cells, to prevent cancer and so on. So it was fascinating. And I met Judith at the P53 conference. And then when I started doing this, I thought, wow, I'll go and see her again. She's a most impressive lady.
Yeah,
she really is.
Way you describe her in the book is, you know, a very mild-mannered, softly spoken woman. And I remember just thinking, imagining like what she speaks like. And then I watched an interview with her, actually, with Dr. Rhonda Patrick online. And she's exactly how I imagined. You have this crazy ability.
But she's also, she's lovely and graceful. She's sort of like a ballerina. She's lovely. She's got this halo of lovely dark hair. She was wonderful. Yeah. And she so bright, you know. And she just told, she was brilliant at describing how all these things work.
Yeah. And so how does that relate to, I think I remember you talking about P21 and all these other sort of genes. How does that relate?
It's all, these, P21 is another one in the sort of, P53 is the center of a hub. And what they reckon is, and I don't know whether this is still current, whether this is what they still believe, but it's the key tumor suppressor. And so it gets fed signals from above which say, hang on, we've got something bad happening here. P53 goes and has a look. Then it calls in a whole lot of other genes. And if there's something messed up with the network below or the network feeding into it, then you can get cancer. But if P53 is doing its job absolutely right, you shouldn't be able to get cancer. But there's all kinds of things in the network that can go wrong and stop P53 doing things right.
Right. We talked a little bit about calorie restriction before. That, I think, has hit the headlines, and people are generally aware, like, eating less may be related to increased health span. What is your overall sort of message about the whole calorie restriction community? They sound wonderful, first of all. I remember you talking about the Biosphere Project with all the professors who, you know, in the name of science, restricted calories for this incredible experiment in the middle of the
Arizona. They didn't intend to do it.
Survival, right?
Yeah. No, well, calorie restriction was, it had a very long history. It went back, I think it was the 1930s. There was a guy working in, now I can't remember his name, he was an American guy working in the agricultural sector, I think, and he was looking at animal health and so on. But he restricted the calories of rats, and he discovered that if he had some rats all in a cage, if he gave them a specific diet, which was, you know, full of the right nutrients, if he restricted the calories of some and just let others eat as much as they wanted, the ones with very restricted calories, eating an optimum diet but very restricted calories, they lived a lot longer than the other ones. And so he thought this was an interesting thing. And it was a flurry of interest, and then people didn't get really interested in until sort of 50 years later. Roy Walford, who was the professor of pathology, a very eccentric
pathology
in the States, in one of the universities in California, he cottoned onto this and he looked at it. And people by that stage had found that if you calorie restrict a worm, one of the little, you know, the model organisms that they use in labs, the worms, the mice and the fruit flies and so on, you made a huge difference. With the worms, you could increase their lifespan tenfold. With the flies, they could do it fivefold, I think it was, or twofold. With the mice, you could give them an extra 50% life. And they did it also on macaque monkeys. But Roy Walford wasn't waiting for the macaque monkey research. He said, you know, what works for mice and rats and all these other things, I'm sure it'll work for me. So he started restricting his calories. And he went around with a very, very low calorie diet and very aesthetic and so on. But then he was asked to be the medical officer on this experiment in the Arizona desert where they built a sort of terrarium, and it was supposed to be a self-sustaining ecosystem, and it was supposed to mimic what it would be like to live on Mars or live on the moon or something terrible like that. And the systems were all supposed to feed a feedback loop, and they grew their own food, and they, you know, they had they breathed, and they got some animals in there, but they had plants which would change, you know, taking the CO2 and so on. So it was all supposed to be self-sustaining. And of course, it didn't work out like that. They went very short of oxygen, down to about 14% of what they should have. So they were all a bit scratchy. And their food, they weren't very good at producing their food. And so they found themselves, Roy Walford had to restrict their calories very much. And there's a wonderful picture of them that I found where they're all sort of poring over this very, very depleted looking dining table and thinking, what can we eat? And they're all very thin. So it was an enforced experiment. But what he then sort of checked their physiology, and he said it was absolutely fascinating. He found very much the same thing that they'd found in the rats and the mice and the worms and so on, that all kinds of measures were really, really good. Their sugar control, their just lots of things were really good. And so he reckoned this really worked. And Roy Walford wanted to live to 120 years, but terribly sadly, he got motor neuron disease and he died in his mid-70s. Anyway, he was the sort of poster child for calorie restriction. And now there's a huge community around the world, not huge, several thousand people around the world, and they all eat very little. I mean,
they call the cronies, is that?
They're called the cronies. Calorie restriction, optimal nutrition.
Gotcha.
But I interviewed one over Skype in California, and I thought it was going to be a dreary interview. I thought, you know, he'd be a bit of an evangelist and so on.
Yeah.
He was wonderful. He was terribly funny. He didn't take himself too seriously. And I said to him, you know, it's not a very social sort of thing, a few lettuce leaves and a bit of lemon and so on each day. Have you made friends? And he said, well, I lost quite a lot of them, because he said, I was an evangelist at the beginning,
really?
And I would bend anybody's ear. And he said, you know, a lot of them sort of crept away. But he was very funny. But he'd been doing this for some time. But just before I think I interviewed him, the results from the monkeys, the macaque monkeys, came in. And it, of course, macaques can live to sort of 30 years. So it was a very long time they needed to do the experiment to see whether it actually increased their lifespan. What they found was, the bad news was, it didn't increase their lifespan. But it did increase their health span. They fell off their perch at the very end. And the same with the flies, very often, or the mice, very often they died at a ripe old age, you know, sort of maximum lifespan, but not more. They died at a ripe old age. You couldn't tell what they died of. There was no pathology. So, you know, something had gone. Maybe they'd run out of stem cells or whatever. But so he thought this was really, really good news. So the guy that I interviewed in California, this was just before Thanksgiving, and he said he was going to enjoy Thanksgiving this time, but he was going to keep lowish calories. But because what they discovered was, you don't have to eat a really Spartan diet, but you need to be careful of your calories and so on. But it doesn't need to be sort of half starvation type thing.
Yeah.
So he could let up a little bit. But so just looking at your nutrition, and you'll love this message, looking at your nutrition, making sure you get the right things and not too much of it. Don't overload your system with having to sort of detoxify and get rid of too much stuff. Works wonders, and it really makes a big difference. So that's where you get the biggest bang from your buck. Good nutrition, moderate portions and so on, but not too Spartan. So you can enjoy yourself.
What's become quite popular in the fasting community, I think, or just generally people who are biohacking or try to optimize the nutrition, three levers. I'm quoting Dr. Peter Attia, whose podcast I listen to religiously, of calorie restriction, dietary restriction, and timing restriction. So calorie restriction will be energy control. Dietary restriction would be, you know, not eating crap food, basically high, poor quality fats, and in some cases, yes, lowering refined carbohydrates, etc. But also timing restriction, which goes on to circadian rhythm disruption. And
yes.
I find that super interesting. Have you looked into that much?
I tripped across that while I was doing the research because there's an Indian neuroscientist, actually, he's a gerontologist at the Buck Institute in California.
Dr. Rao, yes.
Ram Rao, wonderful. And he was telling me all about this, and then I've read up quite a lot about it. But he's very strict about that, that you should not eat, you should have sort of 8 hours between your last meal at night and your breakfast and so on, and you should keep to some of these things, and you shouldn't have your big meal at that stage. But and I was very interested in that, and I've read quite a lot about that, and the same thing with the guy who is actually managing to have some effects in treating Alzheimer's. But it's terribly difficult to follow. It really is. It's a lifestyle change that I've found too difficult because I tend not to stop till quite late in the evening, and I don't like to have a big meal at lunchtime particularly.
Yeah, I think that would be quite off-putting for most people who, you know, will live a lifestyle which involves office work, which involves not having a kitchen in the middle of the day. I'm very lucky to have one most of the days when I'm not working in A&E. The general sort of advice that I give to people is to eat in a general window, and that can be starting off with 12 hours, if you like, or 12 to 13 hours. If you start eating at 8, then finish eating by 8 p.m. or 9 p.m.
Really? That's what you suggest?
Yeah, as a general rule of thumb. And what that does, I think, inadvertently, is just make sure that people aren't eating out of boredom. Because if you're sat in front of the TV and it's 9 p.m., feeling peckish, you've had dinner maybe an hour or so ago, you're going to reach for the popcorn, you're going to reach for the sugary snacks and stuff. If you know and you're strict with yourself about, okay, well, I'm not eating now, then it probably reduces your energy consumption. So inadvertently you might be having those effects. But I think there is definitely something in time restriction.
Absolutely. There is a synergistic effect between those three elements. Absolutely. There's no question of that, at least from what I've read and from what I've heard. But as I say, I find with all of these things, the messages are things that we've heard over and over, the same with exercise and so on. But what I found interesting when I was actually looking at it is we hear these messages and there's so much noise, they get contradicted and so on. What we don't often hear is the biology behind it. And that's what I was really looking at. So I was looking at the biology of the calorie restriction. I was looking at the biology of exercise as well, and it's not just building up muscles, it's keeping your immune system healthy and all of that sort of thing. So there's a lot of, you know, sort of, that's why I've been told to do that. That was the message that came
and across. It was really interesting, the bit about Dr. Ra, because he's trained in Ayurvedic medicine, which I need to look into a bit more. It's definitely my heritage. It's definitely something that influenced me through my mum when I was overcoming my own medical issues that we spoke about before. A lot of the principles within ancient medicine, I think, are sort of coming full circle. We're beginning to understand what we knew intuitively, perhaps thousands of years ago, which I find quite... It's just interesting.
It is fascinating. Yeah. It really is. And it's interesting what Ram was telling me. And he got really sort of excited about the whole thing because he realised I was very interested. And I am interested because I come from a very medical background myself. But my dad, years and years ago, started talking about holistic medicine. It was always with in inverted commas because, you know, it wasn't a mainstream thing then. And this was looking at how everything works together. And at that stage, I had just given birth to babies, and I had done some psychoprophylaxis, which is trying to ease, deal with the pain without taking lots of gas and air and lots of pethidine and things like that. And it was brilliant. And I was so skeptical beforehand. I thought, this is a load of old baloney. But I went along with it, you know, having a little giggle behind my hand, me and my husband, at the sort of evangelist who was teaching us this stuff. And it worked like a dream when I came to the actual childbirth. And so my dad got very interested in that and meditation and so on. And so he started to suggest meditation to his patients and things too.
How progressive.
So this was a long time ago. So I'm interested in some of the things which... not everything, absolutely not everything, and I'm sort of super skeptical of just embracing them all and dismissing rational scientific medicine, Western medicine. But I think one needs to have an open mind. And the interesting thing about Ram was he said that at first his wife, they moved to California and she couldn't get satisfaction for her health problems. So she wanted to go to an Ayurvedic doctor. And the Ayurvedic doctor said to Ram when he came along with her, you should study this. He said, no, I'm a neuroscientist. I'm a Western trained. No. And then he said, well, we've got a course at the weekend. Why don't you just pop along? And he popped along and his mind really opened. But he and this other guy, who was also one of the top gerontology neuroscientists in the States, I think he'd been the director of the Buck Institute of Aging at one point. Okay. He got very interested in this, and he found that when he started talking about this sort of thing, you know, it was really difficult to get funding for it because it's seen as fringe and it's seen as snake oil stuff. So again, you're up against this sort of stigmatized thing. Yeah. But personally, I haven't anything to lose by keeping my mind open, though I think you can go too far.
Yeah, I totally
you have
agree.
To, you have to keep your critical faculties, but 100%. Don't close your mind to it completely.
Definitely, yeah. And I think that's incredibly progressive of your father, because we were talking over lunch about how he was a tropical medicine specialist and then went into general practitioner thereafter, and your experiences in Sudan and all these different places around the world. But for someone back then to be talking about meditation and these yes. holistic practices, I mean, that's incredible.
It was. He was that sort of, he had that sort of mind. He was very curious about all sorts yeah. of things. And, you know, I think one of the things, you'll probably find this very much as a GP, that it isn't just the science. I remember my dad actually wrote an article, and I was at WHO at the time, and we used to get articles that had been in the paper and so on and put them in the journals. And my mentor at WHO would gather these things, and he took this article by Dr. Peter Abbott, and he said, look at this. It's a fascinating article written about the art of medicine. And he said, I think we should see if we'll write to the author and see if we can put this in our journal. I said, I'll write to the author. I said, I'll phone him if you like. And it happens to be my dad. Because it really was about, what does the patient feel is wrong with them? What are their beliefs about all this sort of stuff? And so you need to, it needs to be a dialogue, a real dialogue with yeah. the other person's superstitions or understanding and all of that sort of thing. So Dad was really into the art of medicine as
well
as the
science. That's amazing. I've definitely got to read that. And if I haven't come across it, it sounds something that I may have already read maybe a few years ago. But that brings me on to a point actually about pediatrics. I'm taught by some of my really respected colleagues in pediatrics to trust the intuition of the parents. The mother, if they know there's something wrong with the child, don't brush it off. It's not always, the child could be presenting and they might look fine to you, their observations might be, but there's something off. Just look into it a little bit. You never know, there could be something there. And I think it's this sort of like intuition that we can't quite tangibly quantify, but we should respect.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that really does speak to me, even in clinical practice and A&E as well.
I mean, in everything, and geriatric medicine and gerontology, right the way through, if the people who know a person very well are uneasy about something, it's worth listening to them until they become a real pain in the backside.
And that actually brings me to a point about, so there's two things I want to talk about, nutrient sensing genes that we're talking about in a second, but the story about the patient with a Wegener's, the condition where they age very young.
Werner's syndrome.
I'm thinking about something completely different.
Werner's syndrome.
And how, I think it took him to his 30s to get the diagnosis.
Terrible, terrible, terrible. Yes, I mean, Werner's syndrome is really, really sad. It's one of these premature aging conditions. And literally, you start to get all the sort of symptoms of aging. Not all of them. This is why it's just, you get a lot of the symptoms. You start to get arthritis. You start to get heart problems. You can even get sort of dementias and things like that very early on. And but this guy that I met with Werner's, he said that he loved to run. He loved to do sports and so on. But he'd get absolutely crippling things with his knees and his joints and so on. And he had a whole lot of, and he had diabetes as a very young person. Nobody, you know, whenever he went for checkups and so on, he'd go to a rheumatologist or he'd go to a dietitian or something. All of these different people would find something wrong with him, and they'd give him, tinker around with bits and pieces, but he could never get satisfaction. But he went to a doctor at one of the, at his workplace. They all had an MOT from some doctor, and she was just very wise. And she said, I wonder if all of these things are related, if we're onto something here. And sure enough, and I can't remember exactly how he found out. I think he had to have, he had a gene test, yes. Yeah. And they found it. But, you know, too often that's the story. They're focusing on an individual symptom and not seeing the big picture.
And it really did resonate with me because I think that spells out a lot of what we do wrong with modern medicine. There's a lot of things that we do right. I'm not discrediting that at all. But what we do wrong is siloing symptoms and giving individual diagnoses as if that's going to change it. And I think I remember from the chapter, you know, he got the diagnosis and was like, oh, and there's going to be something that we're going to do about it, right? But actually, it comes down to this issue of treating aging like a disease, and we don't actually have that many treatments. We just treat things individually. But the issue about treating symptoms in isolation, I think, is something that mars a lot of what we do as Western medical practitioners. And for someone to have waited that long,
yes,
it leaves a bit of a bad taste in my mouth.
It does. Yeah. It's terrible. And I think, one of the fascinating things about, you know, he had a lot of the different facets and the pathologies of aging, and so they were all looked at separately. But actually, to a great extent, that's been one of the problems with geriatric medicine. You've got the person who will deal with your Alzheimer's, the person who will deal with your diabetes, the person who will deal with your heart, the person who will deal with your joints, the person who will deal with your bones, not looking at them all in one. And one of the clearest messages that came from my book, which I found absolutely fantastic, was that the single biggest risk factor for that whole panoply of geriatric diseases is the aging process itself. So if we can come, you know, they're the branches of the tree. The roots of the tree are the aging process, your immune system that's getting old, your senescent cells that are accumulating, the inflammation in all sorts of things, all of these things. So if you can treat, if you can find a way of slowing that process or ameliorating that process, you can actually affect all kinds of things. And that's what comes, you mentioned earlier something that I know will probably set a lot of your listeners really their teeth on edge when you say, you know, aging is a disease, yeah, because we're all getting old and it's terribly stigmatizing. And it's inevitable. You cannot stop time, but what you can do is perhaps slow the process itself. But it's very provocative, the very idea that aging might be a disease. But when you recognize that it's the root cause of all of these other things, and that if you can do something about the root cause, you can actually prevent or ameliorate a lot of the other things, then it makes sense to look at it as a disease process in its own right. Because up until now, pharmaceutical industry isn't interested in an anti-aging pill, because so what? It sounds like it's just a sort of cosmetic thing. But if you can label this as, if this is something that the NHS says, yes, well, we can do something about it at this stage. If it's labeled as a disease, it's then something that's worth intervening in. And big pharma are the only people with the clout to actually go after those kind of drugs. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword. I hate the idea of pathologizing old age or medicalizing old age, but if it's going to release the logjam of people wanting to actually translate what they've learned about gerontology into something that's going to affect all those or prevent or ameliorate those other diseases, then it's worth looking at how we call it and whether it is a process that we should be intervening in.
There's so much of that I really want to unpack, because I think right at the start of your book, when Richard Farrago is talking about the amount of money spent on aging as issues with aging, it's pitiful.
Pitiful.
Considering the amount of money that we spend on treating illnesses, yeah, of old age.
Well, and what I is think, it? Isn't it something like, well, isn't
0.03 billion, I think, spent on the research.
On the research.
Yes.
But what is it? Is it a third? Is it? It's nearly
it's
a half.
It's well over a third.
NHS budget goes on people over the age of 65.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've got this massive need, and the policymakers and the funders haven't cottoned on to the fact that this is where the research needs to be, not on each of the individual pathologies, but on the root cause.
Yeah, and dig a little bit deeper, and this is why I'm so passionate about food, and we really should be looking at our lifestyle and food as medicine, because medicine being the use of interventions and substances to prevent as well as treat illnesses. We really need to be looking at the foundations of how we actually prevent a lot of the illnesses that are burdening our healthcare systems globally.
Absolutely.
Not just in this country. I want to go on to back to calorie restriction, because it brings me onto the topic about nutrient sensing genes. I think it's become quite fashionable to talk about FOXO and the other nutrients. It comes from the DAF2 gene that I think was isolated in the worm.
Yes.
But tell us about FOXO, because I find that whole area of nutrient sensing super, super exciting. And the different lifestyle factors that we can do to turn on these nutrient sensing genes.
Well, FOXO is a very big part of what's called the nutrient sensing mechanism. And just in its simplest way, this is its job. And I'm not sure that it's FOXO itself. There's a whole lot of them. Yeah. And I can't remember exactly which gene does what. Yeah. But it's part of an absolutely crucial nutrient sensing mechanism, which is always looking to see what fuel comes in and how best to spend it. And this is why, this is one of the things they think is so important in calorie restriction, that they reckon if you've got low amounts of fuel coming in, then your body will say, well, we ought to divert this towards maintenance and upkeep of the body rather than laying down fat and that sort of thing. So this is super important. And yeah, so basically, it's a mechanism which will allocate the resources as they come in. And it's just crucial to everything. Everything we do, every way our body works, goes through that system, and it gets, you know, its own resources allocated by that system. So it's very, very important. But as you say, when they were looking at the genes which do increase longevity, and the longevity genes, there's one or two of them. There's, yes, DAF2, and there's one which they call AGE1, the first one they found, which they tinkered around with that, and they found they could increase the lifespan of worms and so on massively. And people got very excited by that, because they realised that it's not just wear and tear, which a lot of people had just thought ageing was a question of we've been around a long time, you know, buffeted by the weather and the what we eat and stress and all sorts of things. That's what aging is. But they realized it does have, there are a lot of genes sort of regulating it as well.
Yeah.
And that was, and when they tinkered around with some of those, just some individual genes, they managed to make huge differences in these animals. But then people sort of step back and they see this, it comes out in the media, and they think, oh, wow, can they do that for humans? Well, you can't do exactly that, just tinker around with some of these genes. Even if we've got the same ones, you can't tinker around with your AGE1 and keep you going to 500 or whatever.
Yeah.
Or 10 times as long as you might live.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's quite fashionable to think, oh, if I just upregulate this particular gene. Whereas actually in reality, that I think you said in the book, there's over 300 different
yes.
genes that are related
yes.
to lifespan.
Well, that's the thing. But they reckon that 25 to 30% or something of your lifespan, your natural lifespan, is, you know, down to the genes. And the rest is, you know, your environment and the interaction of your genes and that sort of thing. So the genes do have a role to play. But so many things have a role to play. That's the truth. But this nutrient sensing mechanism, of which FOXO is a massive part, is one that they really... As you say, they're focusing on some of those really important genes in
yeah.
that.
One thing I find quite interesting about the whole lifespan gene theories, well, not theories, but, you know, the whole nutrient sensing mechanism, is that in reality, they only represent sort of 20%, I think, of lifespan, whereas the rest of it is all about your lifestyle, which makes me quite excited, because it's not as if your lifespan is set from birth, as we were sort of led to believe when we were, you know, we just encoded the human genome. There's a lot that we actually have within our control using things like calorie restriction, some other elements of lifestyle that we'll probably go into later.
Absolutely. But this whole debate about our maximum lifespan, yes, our genes give us, you know, if you come from a family of long-lived people, it tends to be you've got the genes are working in your favour. But there's a huge debate as to whether there is a natural limit. And, you know, there was this woman in France, Jean Calment, uh-huh. or whatever her name was, and who died at 120, 126 or something. And they reckoned that was the upper limit. And there was big debate about if you keep the body healthy, can you go on a lot longer than that? Can you override it, is that really the natural lifespan? And no, it hasn't been resolved. It really hasn't. There are people who passionately think there is a maximum lifespan, and people who think that no, if we can easily override that by lots of healthy health and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, because I remember you go into the arguments actually back, like, you know, I think it was in the 1950s, or you'll probably be able to correct me, about how we used to think if you give a cell a perfect environment, a nutrient-dense medium, you can allow them to live indefinitely. But actually, that's not the case. And there is a set point, isn't there? I
think there is, yes. Yeah. Yes. Now, that's actually a fascinating story. Yeah. Because, you know, okay, there's a lot of hocus pocus in Eastern type medicine, or this is what people are worried about. There's a lot of hocus pocus in all sorts of things. But there are also lots of little dogmas in science and in medicine. And one of them was Alexis Carrel, okay, who won a Nobel Prize. And he was he had ostensibly kept the cell from a chicken heart alive in a test tube or in a petri dish for years and years, for decades. Yeah. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And so the idea grew up, the dogma grew up, the received wisdom was that these cells will go on and on. They divide, you know, they were dividing and dividing and dividing. They were dividing cells, that they will go on dividing forever as long as they've got the right temperature and the right medium and so on. But what, then you got this guy, Leonard Hayflick, who came along, and he was a cell biologist and he was working in Philadelphia. And he was a really seriously good cell biologist, and he was creating cell lines for that. They were working on vaccines for viruses. And he noticed in his lab that all of the cells, they would go for so many cycles and then they would stop. And he did this and did this and did this. And he said it looked as though this was a natural thing. He was doing nothing wrong with his medium or anything like that. So he started to get really interested. So he put out this paper that cells have a natural lifespan and then after that they will stop dividing. And this was such a challenge to the dogma that, but what they discovered, he turned out to be absolutely right, but he couldn't get his paper published for a long time. And then in the end he did. And of course it's now well known that the cells do have a finite lifespan and they do then senesce. But what they discovered was when it finally did come out, what had happened was the Alexis Carrel, of course, was not doing all his own experiments. He got this team of lab technicians, and apparently they were finding their cells dying after a certain time. They thought, oh shit, you know, this is not what's supposed to happen. I must have done something wrong. I've got the temperature wrong, or I haven't put the right medium in. So they'd just change the cells and right, go on and on. And Alexis Carrel would come in and look and just assume it was the same cell. hadn't dared admit it.
So the laboratory staff were literally changing.
They were, yes. But I presume they were doing it individually rather than saying to their pals, I've done this, because
exactly,
they thought, you know, I've slipped up, so they didn't admit it. And then Leonard Hayflick came along. And the great thing is now it's recognised that cells have, and I think they have varying ones depending on the different tissues and so on. But this is known as the Hayflick limit. They reach the end of that Hayflick limit. And that's where, and then people say, well, how does it know when it's come to the end of the limit? And that's where you get your telomeres.
Yes, yeah. And that brings us beautifully onto your incredible interview. Did you meet Elizabeth Butler?
I didn't meet her, no. Unfortunately, I didn't. There was one or two people that you know, I couldn't get round to see them all. But sure, there was lots of material because she'd won a Nobel Prize. And the Nobel site on the website is wonderful because you have a wonderful biography, you have interviews with the people, you have their speech to the Nobel people, so it's really super good. But people then say, well, how would a cell know when it had reached the end, when it had reached the Hayflick limit? And what we've got on the end of our chromosomes is these little things called telomeres, and somebody has described them as like being like the caps on the end of shoelaces. They're little caps on the end of your chromosomes, and every time your DNA copies itself, a little bit of this gets chipped off, and the telomeres don't get copied, they get chipped off. When they get, they're protection for the chromosomes. When they get too short to protect the chromosome adequately, then the cell knows it's time to senesce, and so it doesn't divide any longer. But then people were wondering what it is that keeps the telomeres going and all of this sort of thing. And Elizabeth Blackburn was the person who found this. And this was absolutely fascinating because then they found an enzyme that that you can repair the telomeres. And so you can ostensibly override the senescence of cells with this stuff. So, you know, all of these little bits and pieces come into the picture, and it's just fascinating. And that's what I love about following these stories. You find yourself thinking, well, I wonder how that works and why such and such. And then you get the opportunity to go and speak to these people or phone them or read about them.
Totally, yeah. Because, like, the way the story, it feels like a story because you've written it. It's almost like it's this novel and you're discovering things. It's fantastic. But if someone was just going into, you know, doing a Google search on anti-aging, they probably wouldn't find out about all these different things that feature into the root cause of what actually is leading to aging.
It wouldn't. I mean, there's lots of stuff about, there's probably stuff now, quite a lot of stuff about what they call senolytics, which is drugs to get rid of the senescent cells and so on, because that is a really hot area. But what they've managed to do is Richard Farragher, who you've mentioned several times, he and his wife Lizzie Osler and another person, I think Lorna Harris, down in another university, they were working on a drug which can tinker around with the senescent cells and what makes them senesce and all this sort of thing, and just tinker around so that you can get rid of some of them or get rid of the ones that you don't want and this sort of thing. Absolutely brilliant. So there are lots of little things coming along in the pipeline, but not sweep away the whole lot, not just, you know, cleanse your body of senescent cells.
Exactly. Yeah, it's almost like you may need to, you'd have to think about how you dose and actually how you intervene and introduce these different chemical compounds.
Absolutely.
Because, like you said, a senolytic, getting rid of every senescent cell in your body is not a good thing. It's almost like you might need to cycle them. And the same thing with calorie restriction and fasting. People don't really know how to use this as a clinical tool at this point because there are vast different effects depending on the person, their background, the genomic history.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the thing, as you'll have found with nutrition, is that it is so difficult to control for, because the what you eat and its relationship with exercise and so on, it affects everything in the body. So to actually pinpoint what's gone in and where it's gone and what effects it's had is so difficult. So these are really, really difficult areas of science. But what they're trying to do with the senolytics, with the calorie restriction, is find some sort of drug which they can use instead of restricting calories. But I mean, you know, to a certain extent, I'm sure it could be useful. I'm sure it would be very useful, but it also seems like the lazy way around. You can eat all these cream cakes and you can pig out and then just take a pill and it'll sort out your nutrient sensing mechanism or whatever.
Yeah, it's one of the mechanisms by which I think resveratrol is purported to work, right, as being a calorie restriction mimetic, it's described. And I think earlier on it was thought not to have efficacy, but now there's a resurgence in the research that's actually proving, you know what, it could actually mimic calorie restriction to the point where it could be a supplement to take. Yeah. And I know a lot of people prior to the research actually, you know, being founded and actually saying definitively, yes, it might have a use, and most people are using it. But perhaps safely. I'm not too sure what the side effects are of a high dose of resveratrol, but you certainly can't get it from dry peanuts and wine doses that we're talking about.
And dark chocolate.
Yeah, and dark chocolate as well, yeah. That brings us on to, so the difference in what clinical effect there is based on your culture, your ethnicity, and you described that a bit in the discussion around Alzheimer's and inflammation. So there's that, the community of Tismene, I think they're called?
The Simani people in I think it's the Bolivian Amazon. Absolutely fascinating, because yes, they found, I mean, the brain and Alzheimer's is still a huge black box. I mean, they've, as I was saying earlier, they've made huge advances in understanding the brain and knowing what the brain does, but there's still huge bits of the jigsaw missing. And so we haven't really got to the bottom of Alzheimer's. But what they have found that there are risk factor genes, and there's one called ApoE E4. And we have ApoE, several versions of that, and there's E2 and E3 and E4. E4 is the bad one, and they reckon that increases the risk of Alzheimer's, I think, up to 12 times or something. It's quite a nasty one. But this is, and they found, you know, this is where they suddenly realised that their research has been focused on white males, not so much on women, not so much on other ethnic groups. And they found among the Somali, it's actually protective against Alzheimer's. They found this, or against dementias of any sort. They found the same, that it's got very much an ethnic thing. They found the same, doesn't have the same risk factors in, or the risk profile in Nigeria. Yes. So all kinds of things, which is really fascinating. So they looked back and they thought, well, what is this all about? And they reckoned that this gene might also, because one message that has to come across is that one gene doesn't do one job.
Absolutely.
Genes can do so many different jobs. They can produce so many, depending on where they switched on and when they're switched off and all that sort of thing. They've got lots of roles. And so you look at one and you say, like with P53, this is a tumour suppressor. It's doing lots of other things as well. And APOE4 is doing a lot more than just increase your risk for Alzheimer's. And one of the things they find is that it's probably very good for, if you've got intestinal parasites and that sort of thing, it's protective against those kind of things. So that's why it's persisted in some of these communities. So there's all kinds of really interesting things. So it makes them realise that you need to broaden your research base of who you're doing the research in. Who, and yeah, women, there's a gender effect, yeah. And there's an age effect, and there's an ethnic background effect in a lot of these things.
Yeah, there's definitely like an underrepresentation across the board with different ethnic backgrounds, and that, you know, if we didn't do research, that we wouldn't understand or find out about the Nigerian paradox, which I find fascinating. And I think, you know, just labeling APOE4 as an allele that we know is bad, it's again, it appeals to that sort of reductionist mentality.
Absolutely.
That we need to get rid of in science.
And it's one of the things that's quite dangerous when people have their genomes read.
Yes.
You know, somebody will come along and say, oh my God, I got APOE4,
yeah.
I'm at such and such a risk. And it's not quite as simple as that. It really isn't. It's not, you know, as mostly your genes are not your destiny. They may play a very big role. There are certain genes, like the familial Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's that runs in families, the hereditary type, that does seem to be, it is your destiny. If you have the mutant gene or the version of the amyloid precursor protein, the APP gene, then, you know, you're going to get it at some point, which is pretty sad. And there are one or two genes that really are nasty like that. But most of the time, it's not your destiny. There's lots of little things can be done to
change it. I think there's around 100 or so genetic mutations that definitely lead to a phenotype, so a physical attribution of the genetic makeup that you have that will essentially determine the deterministic genes. Whereas there are, I don't know how many, but there are plenty more SNPs,
yeah,
or single polynucleotide polymorphisms, rather, that will lead to variants that in some cases you can change with your environmental influences,
yes,
as
yes.
well, that's under your control. One of the things that you talked about, I think, in the book, which I need to educate myself on more, is the environment and the impact of pollution and how that may play into the Alzheimer's story as well. What do you make of the environmental pollutant story? And do you think we should be, because I keep on getting asked about masks, especially in urban areas.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
Well, it's a really difficult one. I can't bear masks. You know, this is where one sort of natural sort of reactions to things comes in. But I think it's very persuasive, the research on pollutants, because as I say, they know what the pathology of Alzheimer's, and Alzheimer's is the most common dementia of old age, or much the most common dementia of degeneration of the brain. And we know what the pathology looks like. And you've got these, you know, amyloid plaques, and you've got these tau tangles. The pathology is very obvious. But there was a time when people thought, well, one or other of those is what's killing the neurons. Now, they're not so sure, because they've tried clearing out both of them and trying stopping them happening, and it doesn't seem to make that much difference. Or they've done autopsies on people, post-mortems on people, and found their brains absolutely clogged with it, and they were absolutely crystal clear in life.
Yeah, yeah.
So
the
there's
nun
all these
that you mentioned
the
in
nun,
the story.
Yes,
yeah,
there's a wonderful
yeah.
story about a nun in the book. Yes, who was really, I can't remember what her name was, Sister Sarah or something, but she had this really crystal brain, and she was very old when she died, and her brain was absolutely clogged with amyloid. And some people say, no, the amyloid and the tau are they're like tombstones. They mark the place where neurons have died, but they're not what killed the neurons. On the other hand, with familial Alzheimer's, where it is a gene which is producing the amyloid, there's quite clearly a very close connection between the two. So there's really still lots and lots of debate about this. Yeah. The pollution thing, I think it's very persuasive. I really do, because they're still looking for all kinds of things that might be causing this. And I went to see this lovely guy who got involved in gerontology when there really wasn't a field. I said to him, when did you enter the field? He said, my dear, there wasn't a field when I came into it. I am the field. I was the field. And he's an eminent neuroscientist in the University of Southern California. And he was the one who's been doing the studies with the Somali people, with a bunch of other people who also looking at, because they there's all kinds of diseases they're not suffering from that we do. I think their hearts are very strong as well, and their immune systems are very strong, because they're quite an isolated community. But Tuck Finch was looking at those, and he's done a lot of research, and he reckons that air pollution, small particles, not just, mostly actually it is, it's from vehicles, vehicle exhaust and that sort of thing, and power stations and those sort of things, tiny particles. They reckon that those can actually get in through the nose, through, there's a gap in the blood-brain barrier at that point, that it can get into the brain there. And there's lots of evidence that that is important. Some of the evidence has come, again, from lovely stories. Well, they're not such lovely stories. But they found in Mexico City, where there's terrible, terrible pollution, quite a number of people were finding that their dogs had signs of dementia. They were getting disorientated or, really showing signs of being quite befuddled. And they reckon they found signs of a lot of the same sort of things as Alzheimer's in their brains. And they reckoned a lot of that was pollution. So they've been looking at that. And Tuck Finch has been doing experiments with mice. And they've been taking the exhaust from vehicles trundling past on the highway outside the university and putting it in aerosol things and then subjecting mice to this. And they found it's pretty impressive. He reckons something like 50% of the risk of Alzheimer's could be particulate matter, could be pollution. Wow. WHO now reckons that 1 in 14 cases of Alzheimer's might be caused by smoking, because smoking is another aspect of this. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of persuasive evidence. But, I don't think those little masks that people wear can handle that stuff. Yeah. It's the ones with, it's the sort of gas masks people wore during the war.
Absolutely, that you'd need. Yeah.
So these little cloth things around the face aren't going to do it.
Totally, yeah. I mean, I'm getting asked about, the use of those face masks for viruses in general. And there isn't enough evidence that I can see that it's actually going to have a meaningful effect.
What I keep wondering is, why do surgeons wear them? And why do doctors wear them and their hair nets and so on?
Certainly surgeons, when you're talking or anything, the spittle and the airborne
protecting the person rather than...
When you're in front of someone whose abdomen is open or whatever and you're in a sensitive area, then I can. That's just an infection control policy.
Okay, so it's nothing to do with air pollution and that sort of thing.
No, nothing to do with that. But it doesn't stop people doing it.
But I think it is important. This, this thing about exhaust fumes is pretty important.
And this is where, I'm not pro Extinction Rebellion and some of their actions and stuff, but they are bringing to attention a really, really important story. And to my knowledge, I understand that Oxford Street in the middle of London is one of the most polluted roads in the whole of Europe. And we exceeded the CO2 or the environmental pollutant level, I think in January or February of 2019, we exceeded the whole 12-month limit. And that, for me,
it's horrific.
It's horrific.
It is horrific.
And we need to be a lot more. We can't regulate ourselves. If you have a car and you need to get somewhere, you're going to have a car in central London, unless you impose things like taxes and charges and stuff like that. So I think it's definitely a conversation. And
one of the things that one of the messages that comes out of it, I would say, is there was a time when kids used to go to school holding hands of mums and dads or whatever, sometimes on their bicycles. But too often now you find cars idling outside the playground, and that really should be a no-no. It's like people smoking. People don't smoke any longer. So there's a lot of tiny little things people can do which aren't mega changes to their habits. But if they're aware of it, and if they're aware of what a little child passing by, particularly one in a pushchair, gets a face full of exhaust, it's not good at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's lots of those kind of little messages.
Totally. I'm actually going to start populating my lounge with houseplants, because I know that they have been shown to sort of absorb some environmental pollutants. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm trying to get actually someone to have a conversation about that on the podcast, because I think there is a lot that we can do with small little tricks and things like that. So yeah, that'd be brilliant. Lastly, I wanted to talk about, well, there's so many other things that I think we could talk about, but you met with Dale Bredesen, who is a colleague. I've met him a couple of times in the sort of functional medicine community. I think his...
He was the guy who was the head of the Buck Institute
at one point. Oh, he was?
Yes.
There you go.
And he was the one that Ram Rao spoke to, and he was one of the people who didn't say to Ram, you know, you're barking mad, this is all your Eastern nonsense sort of stuff. Yeah. And he listened, and he read Rao's books and was bowled over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think his wife or partner, I think she practices with that sort of Ayurvedic mindset, even though she's conventionally trained as well. He, again, was someone who's like a hard-lined 40-year career history of being a, you know, conventional neuroscientist, who's now come to realize that Alzheimer's, and perhaps even aging on a grander level, has multiple factors that we need to consider when it comes to treatment. And we can't think of this, you know, singular paradigm of one symptom or one illness and one set of treatments. That's, is actually absolutely looking
that,
at
that
the whole
has
thing.
To be one of the really biggest messages that comes out of this whole field, and it's a very strong message in my book. It really just rises out of the book that's absolutely so.
Absolutely. And so from everything that you've sort of gathered over the extent of reading, I mean, it must have taken you, how long did it take you actually?
It didn't take a hell of a long time.
Really?
I mean, when I work on these things, I just put my head down and I get mega fascinated by it. And then I think it took me 2 years.
2 years? Okay, yeah. Well, that's a long time for me anyway. That's a long time.
Yes, it wasn't a few months.
Yeah. Out of everything that you've learned, what do you think about those two questions that I asked you at the start? So is, you know, aging, is it a narcissistic endeavour? And is lifespan plastic? And if so, what can we do about it?
Okay, is it a narcissistic endeavour? I think it absolutely isn't a narcissistic endeavour. And I think we've got to forget that side of things. There's certainly that there are a lot of people who actually are really interested in pushing the limits and living for, you know, maybe five centuries or whatever, the immortalists, and also the transhumanists who think that maybe we can download our brains into computers, get rid of these pesky bodies and so on. That is the sort of lunatic fringe, but there are a lot of people doing that. And if that's your thing, then, you know, you can run with it. But and that I do find narcissistic, because we've got too many people in the world already. It has massive implications for everything, for the dynamics within families, for who's going to, you know, working environment, resources, everything. So I do find that narcissistic. And particularly because, you know, having done the traveling I've done around the world, there are so many other things that need fixing in this world. People who are starving, people who are terribly poor and all of this sort of stuff, and drought, and so much that we could put our very good scientific minds towards. So I think that just to look at, oh, I don't like the idea of dying, I must preserve myself, I find that really off-turning. But the search for increased health span, I think, is absolutely massive. Not just important, it's vital. We can't any longer afford the cost of the NHS, the cost, we don't know how to care for everybody, we just don't. So the more we can do to keep all of us, ourselves, healthy right up to the last few years, hopefully, and independent, that has to be just a wonderful thing. It really does. Yeah. And certainly it's something I want. And you say, is it going to be possible? Yes, there's massive amount. One of the things, the genetic studies have been fascinating. They have, tinkering around with these genes, they've shown that you can do a massive amount. I think the biggest message that comes out of that is not, oh, we've also got Age One and Foxo and all this sort of thing, and DAF too. We can do things with them. What those that research says is, this is something which is malleable. It's plastic, as they say, yes, in inverted commas. Yeah. You can do something about it. So with that knowledge, then it's really important to try and do something. And as I say, Richard and his colleagues and a whole lot of people are getting places with helping to clear away the excess senescent cells. But another very big thing, you know, this exercise thing is hugely important. And one of the things I found interesting was there's, and this is again a lovely little story, in our bloodstream, one of the first responders in our immune system when something is wrong in the body is your neutrophils, and they're going around in your blood system, and they hear ding ding ding, there's something wrong, there's a microbe on board. So they literally push their way between the cells and they go off to find this thing and engulf it, and that's it. And then they call in all sorts of other players in the immune system. Well, as you get older, these things lose their sense of direction and they go blundering around. Where did I hear that? Where did I hear that? Literally making trouble for things. And the lovely thing is, I gave a presentation the other day and I looked up and I found this on the internet, a picture of a neutrophil coming out of the bloodstream and going to find a microbe and engulfing it. Oh, and I thought, this is absolute Christmas. Yeah. So, you know, and that's happening in our bodies the whole time. Yeah. But as we get older, they get bad at doing this thing. But what they've found is that, so our immune systems are getting elderly. What they find is sedentariness is really, really bad, because our immune systems are sedentary muscles that aren't moving, keep on pushing out little triggers to the immune system, pro-inflammatory signals saying, come here, come here, come here. Even just standing up, putting weight on your muscles, counteracts that. It sends anti-inflammatory signals. So you need to be getting up, not sitting at your desk the whole time. And one of the women, the immunologists in Birmingham, who was discovering all this stuff, she said she goes for a run in the morning before she goes to work. And she thinks that's wonderful. If she sits at her desk all day, it completely overrides almost any good she's done. So she was saying, so she's now got herself a standing desk, because just literally standing at things is important, or nipping up to make a cup of coffee, or nipping across the corridor to speak to your friends or something. So, as I say at the beginning, that what's important, we get all these messages about do this, do this. What I was looking for is the explanations, and you get the explanations. And it's really changed the way I lead my life, apart from this not eating at the right time.
Yeah, that was literally going to be my final question, actually. Are there, apart from, I mean, I use a standing desk. I think it's brilliant. Yeah, it's over there in the corner. I've learned a lot about this area and just nutrition in general, and I've made some changes to my lifestyle. I eat largely plant-based. I have a general eating window.
What time do you have your supper then?
I try to have it at like 6 or 7, and then I leave at least like a 2 or 3 hour gap before going to bed, if I can. But that doesn't stop me on a Friday or Saturday if I'm going out to dinner with friends and we're going at 8 p.m. I'm not going to eat. No.
You're not one of those evangelicals.
No, I'm not an evangelist. And I don't think people should be, because I think part of the enjoyment of life is actually having a dinner with your friends, you know. And this can get a bit all-encompassing sometimes.
It can. Well, the crony community can be a bit tough. But the guy I interviewed was wonderful.
Yeah. So on your two-year journey of researching this, and obviously your P53 book as well, that I'll make sure I link in the podcast notes, what are the main things that you've changed?
I think I take a lot of exercise anyway. I think the eating thing has been very persuasive. I think I've just got more disciplined about these things. You know, I sometimes you just think to yourself, oh, catch the bus. But you know, I got very used to, because I love walking, I got very used to factoring in how long it was going to take me to get places, because I much prefer to be out. I'm not very good at sitting still, even though I've sat still for this hour.
Yeah.
My legs crossed, dying to set off somewhere. But every so often you just die to get on the bus, and then I think to myself, no, and then I will walk up the stairs and things like that. And yeah, and also very much not sitting for 4 hours at a time in front of my computer.
Mm.
What a podcast to record. If you watch the video, you'll just see me smiling ear to ear because it was just such a privilege to have Sue in the kitchen studio and talk to her about her incredible book. She's just a lovely character as well. And if I'm going to summarize the topics of our discussion, it would be calorie restriction certainly does have legs, and combining that with nutrient density is certainly one way in which we can reduce the likelihood of the issues around aging. And nutrient density is plenty of plants, lots of colors, lots of diversity. Those are essentially the things that I talk about in both of my books and everything that we do in the Doctor's Kitchen here. The other thing are the potential use of anti-aging medications, senolytics, calorie restriction mimetics, and those are probably going to come into fashion a bit more over the next few years. I currently don't recommend anyone experiment with them. They're unlicensed, and a lot of people are taking them, perhaps misguidedly, because I think, as we alluded to on the podcast, there are certainly things that make me reserved about it, mainly the cancer risk. However, there are some instances where in an experimental setting, there might be some use for experimenting essentially with these different molecules. So one for the future, perhaps. The other thing is exposure to environmental toxins. So we did talk about this, it's a bit of a controversial subject, trying to get yourself in nature and trying to minimize the impact of environmental pollutants. It's easier said than done, obviously, because a lot of us live in urban environments where we're exposed to toxic fumes from a whole bunch of different pollutants, mainly traffic. Being the change that you want to see, I think, is perhaps my best advice there. I try and minimize my use of my own car, and I think it's the collective actions of small changes that will lead to an overall huge change, hopefully. The other aspect of that is governmental change, so writing to your MPs, bringing the attention to this, and I think there are some scary statistics out there that we need to be mindful of. We didn't get to talk about it on the pod, but stress, cortisol levels, excess cortisol levels, certainly does play a part in the aging process. So being mindful, meditation, as well as engaging activities that actually bring you closer together, your family members, your friends, is something that I would highly encourage. One of the anecdotes of the nun who donated her body to science and ended up having a huge number of features of Alzheimer's, despite not displaying those features in her daily life, was explained in some part by her connection to her faith, to her community, her church community, this insatiable love of singing as well. I know it sounds strange, but she definitely did have community spirit. And so I think there's certainly a psychological element that protects us when we age. And so engaging in things that inspire creativity are things that we should all be mindful of as well. I'm going to stop waffling on there. Please go and check out my guest, Armstrong_Sue. Check out Borrowed Time, brilliant book. All the links are on my website, thedoctorskitchen.com. Make sure you subscribe to the newsletter. Give this a 5-star review if you liked it. It really does help. And have a fantastic, fantastic day. I really hope this has helped you and inspired you to live a healthier, happier life and given you the tools in which to do so. Catch you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.